Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Even 50 years after President Johnson declared war on poverty, most people still link it with either big cities or the countryside. And of course, there's a lot of poverty there. But get this, today it's the suburbs, places like Johnson and Clay counties, that house a larger and faster growing poor population than either cities or rural areas. All this suggests that poverty itself is changing. It's becoming more regional in scope. But why is poverty growing in the burbs, and how should society respond? That's our topic today. Our guest, Elizabeth Kneebone, is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of the report Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. She was the keynote speaker at yesterday's Human Services Summit hosted by United Community Services of Johnson County. Elizabeth, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Also here is Valerie Carson. She's the planning director for United Community Services. And Valerie, good to have you too.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Elizabeth, what's going on out there? I mean, people still do associate poverty with the big city and rural America, but we're seeing a paradigm shift. At least that's how I'm looking at it here.
That's right. Particularly since 2000, we've seen some really rapid changes in where poverty is, who it's affecting. But our perceptions largely haven't kept pace. You know, between 2000 and 2012, across our nation's largest metro areas, the suburban poor population grew by 65%. And that's more than twice the pace of growth that occurred in the big cities that anchor those regions. And with that growth, we actually passed a tipping point. And there are now more poor residents living in suburbs than in big cities. In fact, 3 million more poor in 2012.
Well, the policy implications of that are huge. But you're so right. People just don't look at it that way. That's not how people view the world.
That's right. I think there's still this sort of popular perception or thinking around poverty that this is still an inner city problem or it's isolated rural communities. And that, like you said, is still true. Poverty is still an entrenched challenge in a lot of those communities. It's just that now it's touching more people and places than before. And a lot of the suburban communities who face this rapid change in recent years just aren't equipped to deal with the challenges that they're seeing today.
You know, Valerie, Elizabeth is talking, giving us the macro view of what's happening around the country. No question all this is happening here in Johnson County and elsewhere in the metro, right?
Yes. In fact, in that same 2000 to 2012 timeframe, the number of people who were in poverty grew 144%. It was a very dramatic sweep upward.
Are you talking about the metro area here?
No, I'm talking about in Johnson County itself.
Johnson, 144%.
We've gone from 1 in 30 Johnson County residents were living in poverty in 2000 to 1 in 15 in 2012.
So in 12 years, that's a doubling. Am I seeing that right?
The percentage, the proportion has doubled. The actual number has more than doubled. We've gone from about little over 15,000 in 2000 to in 2012, there were 37,500.
But that's not how people view Johnson County. That's not what Johnson County is supposed to be all about.
No, it is not the perception, and that's part of what we struggle when we want to talk about addressing an issue, because at first, people have to be able to understand that there is an issue.
You know, one of the issues, and we'll talk about lots of things here, but one issue that characterizes, you know, suburban poverty, Elizabeth, is this idea that it's not concentrated in one area, as so many people at least think of the cities. Certain parts of any one city would be populated with more poorer folks. But when it comes to suburban poverty, it's scattered, right?
That's right. It's spreading over greater distances. It's moving beyond sort of older inner ring suburbs, I think, which we've longer understood have been struggling with poverty, into more exurban, even more affluent places that we often think of are immune to these trends. So it's spreading over greater distances and many communities. But even still, at the same time, as it's sort of becoming more regional in its reach, poverty is also reconcentrating in some ways. Kind of, we're seeing neighborhoods that may have been under 10% poverty tip upwards to 20-30% in some cases. So even as it's becoming more regional, we are seeing pockets of concentrated disadvantage beginning to emerge in suburbs alongside cities.
No, Valerie, I'm gathering that the fact that it's more scattered, does that make it harder for public officials to address the core issues that's behind it?
It makes it more difficult. I think the other thing that makes it more difficult is that often in urban areas, you're underneath one jurisdiction or one city that's able to look at the problem and then address it in that particular geographic region. Mm-hmm. When you're in some place like Johnson County, what you're looking at is 20 different municipalities, and each of them have their own view into it. And some of them see the bigger picture, and some of them feel like they need to really focus on their own residents, which makes it a real challenge to be able to address in a holistic way.
So a sense here that public policy, public servants, public officials aren't really keeping up with it. Is that accurate or not?
I don't think it's that they're not keeping up with it. I think actually in Johnson County, they're becoming much, much more aware of it. It's just it's a challenge to try to get their head around, well, what does that mean then? And mm-hmm. what can I do, or what can my city do? And that's where Elizabeth's strategies have been really helpful in helping us think how to better collaborate, work together strategically in order to address something that's affecting the entire county and all of its residents.
We'll talk about those strategies in just a few minutes. And Elizabeth, one thing we haven't gotten to here yet is why. I mean, why are we seeing this shift from cities and countryside to the suburbs? What's going on out there?
So there have been a number of different factors that have helped drive these trends over several years. In fact, decades. We've seen this unrolling in many places. In some cases, it's the fact that, you know, suburbs have been growing faster than cities. And as they're getting bigger, they're adding more people. They're becoming more diverse, you know, both economically and demographically. You know, some of this relates to shifts in the housing market and in where jobs are located. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we look at this region, the Kansas City region, like many other major metros, jobs continued to shift away from downtown throughout the 2000s. More than half of jobs are located more than 10 miles away from the downtown.
So that gets people out closer to the jobs.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But the challenge here is that we have jobs that are shifting outwards. A lot of the jobs that are even, you know, more suburbanized are things like services, retail, construction, that have a lot of lower paying jobs. Mm-hmm. But they're often, the jobs are growing in different parts of the region than where affordable housing is or where the low income population may be located. Mm-hmm. So as poverty spreads out into these suburban communities, especially when you don't have public transit in place or affordable housing, you know, in these communities, it creates a sort of mismatch between where jobs are and where people live. And that makes it that much harder to work your way out of poverty over time.
We're talking about the suburbanization of poverty. I gather that this trend we're talking about here of poverty moving out into the suburbs, this isn't confined to Kansas City or to Chicago. This is a national trend we're seeing. Is it going on everywhere?
Yes, that's right. Almost every major metro, 93 out of the 95 largest metropolitan areas, saw their suburban poor population grow in the 2000s. So this is something that all kinds of communities are dealing with. Different sorts of regions, you know, older manufacturing metros, stronger markets like a Seattle or a Bay Area, you know, Sunbelt communities that were hit hard by the housing crisis. It's touching all sorts of regions and all kinds of suburban communities, as we just discussed, from inner ring to outer ring. This is becoming a very shared challenge across places.
Nationally speaking, is poverty increasing in the wake of the recession, or have we gotten a handle on it? Where are we with that?
So in recent years, the poverty changes that we've seen, it's sort of leveled off. You know, particularly following the recession, we saw poverty rapidly increase. In fact, we reached record levels in terms of the number of people living below the federal poverty line.
Back in what, 2009 and 2010?
Right. That's right, following the worst of the recession. And now we've sort of leveled off. But what's concerning here is that generally, if we look to past recessions, as unemployment has improved, you know, as we see the unemployment rate go down, then we tend to see the trickle effects, the after effects in poverty also declining. And we haven't seen that yet. We're years into a recovery, but because that recovery has been so uneven and unevenly shared, poverty has remained sort of stubbornly stuck at these elevated levels. So it's really sort of growth and this prosperity hasn't reached down the economic ladder to help people who are still struggling in the wake of the recession.
Valerie, as Elizabeth was saying that, you were nodding your head. We're seeing the same thing here in the metro.
Very much the same thing. In Johnson County, if you look at the numbers that were in 2009 that were in poverty, we're almost at that exact same level here in 2012, which was our last count. And even though our unemployment levels have dropped significantly, which tells us that those people, many people may be going back to work, but the kind of work that they're engaged in is they're underemployed. They're not household sustaining type jobs.
And your comments about poverty, you know, staying relatively flat, is that applied to all the collar counties around Kansas City, Missouri?
That is consistent with all the other suburban counties in the area, except for, I believe, Platte has been able to reduce some of its poverty, and that may be because it has some industry in it.
Well, this is pretty discouraging, isn't it, Elizabeth, this notion that we're coming out of the throes of the recession, and yet things ain't getting a whole lot better.
Yeah, I think it points to some real structural challenges. You know, with the, I think the recession, as it sort of exacerbated this challenge and saw poverty growing, it brought attention to the fact that more people and places were grappling with these challenges. Because, like I mentioned before, this has been something that's been unfolding for quite some time, but in ways I think it's largely been hidden for a lot of communities. Mm-hmm. So the recession really highlighted the fact that poverty was reaching out and becoming more regional. And yet now we have to face the reality that there are also structural factors that even in a recovery, the types of jobs that we're creating just don't pay enough in many cases to get people who are working full time even above the poverty line. We saw the decline of a lot of middle wage jobs during the recession, and some of the occupations that are growing fastest now in the recovery are things like home health aides or service jobs that may pay $20,000 a year.
Right.
And that's just not enough to keep a family above the poverty line.
Poverty's rise in the suburbs is our topic today. We're wondering if you're living at or below the poverty level in any of the six counties in the greater Kansas City area. Let us know how you're coping with all this. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. You know, when did this shift begin, Elizabeth, this shift from historic poverty, high poverty in the cities and the countryside to an increasing number in the suburbs? When did you said in 2000 this sort of began to change?
It began even before that, actually. If we can look back even to following the war on poverty, and we saw poverty growing across a lot of different kinds of communities. But in the 1980s, that's the first decade where we can see that the pace of growth in the poor population in suburbs started to outstrip the increases we were seeing in big cities. And that's something that has just sort of picked up steam with each decade. The 2000s, I think, were remarkable or striking, one, for the magnitude of growth that we saw in suburban poverty, but also because that was the decade in which we passed this tipping point. And the tipping point to where we first saw more poor in the suburbs than in the cities, that happened even before this recession. So this was really something already underway. And I think it sort of underscores something else that we've been talking about, which is it's not just about people moving to the suburbs, people who are poor moving to the suburbs. Because of some of these structural shifts and other changes going on in regional economies, long-term residents have been slipping down the economic ladder, and they're a large part of this trend, the sort of growth in poverty in these communities.
I'm wondering, again, what our listeners are seeing out there. If your neighborhood has been affected by this, if you're seeing changes where you live, how are you reacting to it? How has it changed your neighborhood? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Option two is to drop us an email to update@kcur.org. Valerie, I mean, describe for us what you're seeing in some pockets in Johnson County. I mean, is it fair to say that what you see, at least in some places, isn't that different from what you see on the east side of Kansas City, or in fact, is it different?
Well, being that I don't have all the demographics for the east side of Kansas
yeah.
City, but I can tell you about who the poor are in Johnson County.
Yeah.
Half of them are a combination of children or elderly above the age of 65 or people who have a disability. And these people are not part of the workforce and are not going to be part of the workforce. The other half of those are working age adults, about 53% of them, and two-thirds of those are working, but they're not making enough money to keep them above the poverty level.
And that's the tough nut, right? Folks who tend to work or do work full time and still don't make enough to get them where they need to be.
Yes. And, I remember the last time I was on the show, we had
yeah.
a caller who called in and said, I was in mid-level management out in southeastern Jackson County.
I remember
and
that
now
call.
I'm working three part-time jobs and I can't make it.
Yeah, I remember that phone call, too. 816-235-2888. Is your neighborhood, has it been affected by growing poverty levels that we're seeing out in the suburbs or not? Are there two or three heavy pockets of poverty in Johnson County, Valerie, or can you not isolate it like that?
I can't isolate it that clearly. I do think we see some lines. If you look at poverty distribution, if you look at the I-35 corridor, that there's some that you can point out there, but it is really very much geographically spread across the county.
You know, the definition of poverty sort of comes into play here, Elizabeth. I mean, can you explain how poverty is defined at the federal level?
Sure. So the traditional measure that we've been using for decades now at the federal level, it's an income measure. It's a gross income pre-tax measure.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's adjusted based on your family size and a bit based on age. So if you have a family of four in 2012, you're looking at the poverty line being roughly around $23,500.
Mm-hmm.
So I think most of us would think that even well above that line, you would feel like you're still struggling to make ends meet. So if anything, it's a conservative measure. And it doesn't reflect a lot of things, I think, that also help determine whether people are making ends meet. For
mm-hmm.
instance, it doesn't take into account taxes. It doesn't take into account cost of living differences or changing household prices, health care costs. But it also doesn't take into account things that help people get
mm-hmm.
by, like the earned income tax credit or some other programs like housing benefits may not be reflected in that. So it's a rough measure, but it does give us a sort of a conservative estimate and a standard by which we can measure over time at a local level to see what changes have happened.
Valerie, does that definition of poverty differ at the local level?
It does not differ. It is a federal definition that is used everywhere. But as Elizabeth alluded to, it does not take into account cost of living. So
mm-hmm.
the cost of living in Johnson County is quite high. Our rent is quite high. It continues. The average rents continue to go up. The cost of childcare is very expensive. And when you take into account that of those who are living in poverty, actually 2 out of 5 are actually at 50% of poverty. So extremely deep poverty. Just struggling to get your daily needs met has to be your focus every single day.
Which of those factors tends to bog down a family the most?
Childcare.
Mm-hmm.
Childcare is very expensive.
Very expensive.
And there's really not much assistance that you can get for childcare. There is some assistance you can get for housing,
mm-hmm.
et cetera, and for food, but not so much for childcare.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. I'm wondering if your neighborhood's been affected by the changing demographics here, increasing poverty in the suburbs. 816-235-2888. Mark from Kansas City North, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to point out two indicators I've noticed. I'm afraid I don't really have hard numbers, but I'm a retired teacher from North Kansas School District, 32 years, and one indicator I've seen grow over the years is the free and reduced lunches. I know in some buildings it's over 50%. I couldn't tell you what it is district-wide. It's worse probably in the southern tier of the district than the northern tier, but it is a growing number. And the other indicator I've seen, again, I have hard numbers, but there is a trend that our church, like many churches, I think, provide a backpack program during the school year for students who have food over the course of the weekend. While they might be on free and reduced lunch over the weekend, a lot of them don't have enough food. And so I know that number has grown. More and more backpacks are being packed, to provide lunches for these kids. So there's, this whole concept you're talking about is something I think we've been seeing in Northland as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. Makes sense.
And in Johns County, I think the hard numbers for those free and reduced lunches is one in four students are now on free and reduced lunches. And
say that again. One in four students in Johnson County, Kansas, are on free or reduced lunch. I mean, that is just going to shock people.
And to clarify that, in the Shawnee Mission School District and the Gardner-Edgerton School District, it's 1 in 3.
Man, that's amazing. Again, that's just a different way of looking at the place where we live, Mark, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Elizabeth Kneebone with the Brookings, what about new immigrants coming directly to the suburbs? And, these would be folks who usually have lower incomes than native-born Americans, given their circumstances. What are we seeing there?
So that has been a part of this picture.
Yeah,
as we talk
I was
about
say,
the,
sure it is.
Yeah, the growth in suburbs has in part been fueled by shifting immigration patterns. You know, across major metro areas, we're increasingly seeing new immigrants coming into region and bypassing central cities altogether and moving directly to suburban communities. But when you look at what that contributes to the growth in the suburban poor population, in fact, in this region, it was only about 15% of the increase that we saw. So it's a very small piece of the picture. It's part of the sort of increasing diversity in these communities, and it has implications for services and how we think about addressing the needs of low-income residents. But this was largely a native-born phenomenon in this region and across the country.
Yeah. What are we seeing here locally when it comes to immigrants, Valerie?
15% are 15% of the poor are foreign-born.
Mm-hmm.
But when we go out and we do talk about poverty to the general population, generally the first thing that we are asked are these people moving here? And the data shows clearly that generally for the majority that they are residents, longtime Johnson County residents, and that they're just losing ground economically.
Mm-hmm. Do you have numbers for other counties in the Kansas City metro by any chance, Valerie, or am I catching you cold there?
In the numbers of people who are experiencing poverty?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, I do. And Johnson County, there are actually Johnson County is the second highest, has the second highest number of residents in poverty in the metropolitan area, following Jackson County, in which there are 126,000 approximately.
Mm-hmm.
And then Wyandotte County at 36,900, Cass at 8,600, Clay 19,300.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe Platt is about 5,600.
So it comes right down the ladder there then, yeah. Out of the six Kansas City County area, the lowest rate of poverty in 2012, Platt County, that's still the case then, it sounds like you're saying.
Yes, it is.
Okay, and Wyandotte County came out, my last numbers I had, 23.5%?
Yes, that is correct. Wyandotte County has a much higher proportion of poor than Johnson County. But actually, Johnson County has more poor in actual numbers, and that is a function of the size.
Yeah. Are the needs of urbanites in poverty different than people living in suburbia, Elizabeth? Is there any distinction you can draw there?
So in terms of the urban and suburban poor population, as we've been looking across major metro areas, there are a lot more similarities than differences in that population. I think when we think about the needs of serving a low-income population, what makes it unique in a suburban context is often the lack of resources and connectivity mm-hmm. for those residents. And when I say that, I mean the suburban safety net is often much thinner, much less developed than what we've built up in big cities over decades.
Yeah.
So the types of services are often patchier. For instance, why there may be a food pantry or help with emergency assistance along those lines, often something like workforce programs or job training programs are less present in suburban
yeah.
communities. So the continuum of services is patchier. The providers are often stretched over greater distances or multiple jurisdictions or are themselves quite small. So it can make it difficult to grapple with this rapidly growing need. And you layer on top of that that many municipalities and counties in the suburbs often themselves haven't built up capacity and staffing and resources to deal with a large low-income population. And you face issues because it's spread out over greater distances of things like lack of public transit
yeah.
or affordable, reliable cars that help people connect to the kinds of resources that can help give them a more stable economic footing.
I love that adjective, Valerie, a thinner support network. That's a great word. And I imagine, would you characterize it that way in Johnson County?
I think that's a very good way to describe it. You're spreading it across a great number of people in a very small amount. And often what people experience is because each of those organizations that try to provide some of that emergency assistance have limited funds,
yeah.
then they require that people, these people who have transportation challenges, go from one organization to the next organization to the next organization, trying to amass enough capital to be able to address their immediate need, which is an incredibly frustrating experience.
And what a tough place to be. Again, if you're living at or below the poverty level in our neck of the woods here, we'd like to hear from you. Or if your neighborhood has changed as a result of increasing poverty in the suburbs, that's our topic today. 816-235-2888. Let's go to some calls. And Alicia from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just calling because I have seen my neighborhood change through my kids' schools. I've gotten to know other families. who have shared with me that they've specifically left the safety nets in the city of Kansas City, whether that be, you know, the bus line, Section 8 housing, things like that, and they're moving to the suburbs where they're having to maybe live with another family member, or basically are putting a lot of their money towards apartment rent, specifically so they can get the school district education. I'm not trying to make this a political issue, but many people have told me that they've specifically done this. They've left what they knew. They've left families. They've left that safety net in Kansas City, Missouri, so that their kids can get a different accredited education.
Well, what do you make of that, Alicia? I mean, is it understandable to you, or do you have problems with it?
No, I totally understand it. I see the kids. I see the parents trying their best, and that's one of the reasons as a PTA member, I want to help them.
Yeah. Hey, how has it changed your neighborhood?
I just would say maybe in my specific neighborhood, the apartments, maybe there are more children. I live in a house, you know, adjacent to the property complex, but I wouldn't really say it's changed. I mean, there might be more people standing out on the bus line, off of Choteau Traffic Way is where I'm talking about, but I don't have a problem with it. People are willing to make the sacrifices for their kids. I admire it.
Alicia, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Jeff from Olathe. Jeff, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the rising rates of poverty in the suburbs. Good morning.
Yes, I'd just like to wonder how much Section 8 housing is driving this spread, because I know Section 8 is supposed to be scattering the poor around the city so they're not just concentrated in one area. And I know in my neighborhood I've got an apartment complex that I think most of it is Section 8. And so I see the kids going to my school, my local neighborhood school, and there's, you know, it just seems like a lot of Section 8, and I just wonder how much that's driving this.
Yeah, that's a great question. Elizabeth Kneebone from Brookings, I mean, the whole idea here of Section 8, the philosophy behind it changed in a number of years ago. The caller's right. The government wanted to bring its folks and scatter them, poorer folks, among the rest of us, right, and not make them so easily identifiable.
That's right. And, you know, and it was also the opportunity to give people portable housing subsidies as opposed to concentrating low-income housing in very poor neighborhoods, often in urban communities, where there are a whole host of other challenges associated with being poor in a very poor place. That was the point of vouchers, giving people other options and a chance to live in more mixed income, lower poverty communities. And we have seen that really shift, where these vouchers are being used over time as portability has increased. By the end of the 2000s, about half of housing choice voucher recipients in our major metro areas lived in suburbs, and that was an increase over 2000. Mm-hmm. But it's still, when we look at the overall growth in poverty, again, it's a very small piece of this puzzle. I think this brings up a good question or conversation about growing poverty in the suburbs. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. When we think about concentrated poverty, that is a really negative situation. If you can have a low-income resident living in a mixed-income community with better schools, lower crime rates, access to jobs, that's a good situation that offers opportunity to get out of poverty.
I was going to say, the school thing, as our one caller pointed out, what a smart thing to be doing, I guess, in some
Absolutely,
ways.
Absolutely, and giving your kids a better opportunity for a good education.
You want to break the cycle, you get a better education.
That's right. The challenge is when in suburban communities that aren't equipped to deal with a growing poor population, and you find that you have growing low-income residents in suburban areas who aren't connected to good jobs, there isn't public transportation, there aren't services that can help support their efforts to get into a stable job, then that raises a lot of challenges. And what we've seen with some voucher residents is that they're often not always ending up in high-opportunity neighborhoods. We are seeing sort of increasing pockets of low-income neighborhoods.
So you give up something. You move your kids perhaps to get a better education, but you go to a place where, again, to use your word, the support system network is thinner than it might have been in the big city.
That's right, and that can raise additional challenges again for giving them that kind of ladder to work their way out of poverty. But it just shows that there are real opportunities with this voucher program and those types of interventions. It's just that they need to be used with information as well, so that families really are using them in the most opportunity-rich areas that can help them.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here, and we'll talk about strategies for how to deal with all this. Later on this hour, we'll talk about our national anthem. turning 200 years old. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, this hour we're talking about suburban poverty. We're visiting with Elizabeth Kneebone with the Brookings Institute. Also here is Valerie Carson with United Community Services. You know, yesterday, Elizabeth, you gave the keynote address at the Human Services Summit, and you talked about three strategies to more effectively combat suburban poverty. Give us a little synopsis of what you're talking about there with those strategies.
Sure. So in our research and in our work leading up to a book that we published last year called Confronting Suburban Poverty in America, my co-author, Alan Bruby, and I have spent a lot of time traveling to different metro areas across the country to better understand how these trends are playing out in different places, but also to see what innovative things people are doing to more effectively address region-wide poverty and try to create these connections to economic opportunity. And what we saw is there's leadership coming from a lot of different places. In some cases, it's from elected officials. In some cases, it's philanthropy or a strong nonprofit or a collaboration of multiple partners working together. But they all were doing things that had these three principles sort of at their heart. One is they were figuring out a way to get to a more effective scale, either in terms of the geographic footprint they were working in or the types of services that they were addressing. The second principle is they're figuring out how to collaborate and integrate. So breaking out of the sort of fragmented, siloed approach, you know, cutting across.
That Valerie was talking about
that's
earlier.
Right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, to cut across often jurisdiction boundaries and also policy silos and try to be more collaborative and integrated. And finally, you know, in this era where we have very limited resources, they were figuring out how to fund more strategically. So pulling together public and private dollars in ways to help stretch those resources further to help more people in more places.
Valerie, just reading today that the Johnson County budget is very stretched. So you wonder how much aid, how much help is available there.
Well, but Johnson County has, as a county government, has made a decision to prioritize addressing the issue of poverty. Mm-hmm. And so they realize that it is their budget and they do have to be very careful with it, but that there are many organizations in the county that want to work collaboratively with them because as Elizabeth alluded to, there are limited resources. So being very strategic and targeted and being clear about what kind of outcomes that we want to bring about by our actions and how we do our investments will help us move back towards addressing a lot of these issues.
How good are the different city governments inside of Johnson County at when it comes to working with county government and working with each other, Valerie? What are you seeing?
I think there's a lot of variability, and part of that comes from the fact that some of those municipalities are very, very large, and some of them are very, very small. And so what we'd like to do is try to assist them to come together and have a shared vision about what Johnson County should be and what we all can see as what would be valuable for this community as a whole and how then they can each be part of that.
How successful are you being at creating this shared vision?
I think we're in very early stages. I think that having Elizabeth back after speaking to us about this phenomena, this change of the suburbanization of poverty, and now her coming to us and saying, you know, these are what other different places in the country and other communities have been able to put in place to effectively make a difference. Being able to hear that and say, oh, we see how we could translate that into different kinds of activities, relationships, collaborations here in the county. Now let's get on it.
Okay. 816-235-2888. Let's go back to some phone calls. Vince from Waldo. Vince, welcome to Up to Date.
Hey, thanks for having me. I was calling to find out to get some numbers maybe on median income. That may be a challenge, but what is the average, quote-unquote, poor income within this area? That's question one. Question two is that how will that affect, you know, entrepreneurship if you don't really have that income available? You know, does that encourage entrepreneurship within those communities because, you know, you won't make any money going in?
Yeah, Vince, hang on. Let me see if we can get some answers here. What about this notion? Is there an average you throw out there, Valerie, average poor person's income?
I don't have an average poor person's because, once again, you know, because that is a federal poverty definition, we are constrained by the fact that it has to be about the size of your family. And to be in poverty, you would make, for a family of three, about $19,200 or less a year. Mm-hmm. But about two-fifths of those actually make less than $10,000 a year for those three-person families. So the average, no, I can't tell you. But I can tell you that so that you're in that range of under $19,000 a year if you are a family of three.
How about the impact on entrepreneurship that Vince was asking about?
That I'm probably less knowledgeable about, but I do think it does speak to the fact that as we are working collaboratively and developing this, trying to change perceptions about who Johnson County is and who lives here, it will hopefully speak to the fact that those who are working together at the county and the nonprofit and the philanthropic level, that they will focus on outcomes in improving things for people and then have flexibility about how to use funds. And that could be something where entrepreneurs could make a big difference.
This notion that you're trying to work with communities inside of Johnson County to work together and work with county government, does that kind of cooperation ever extend across the state line? Or is state line – it's a common problem on both sides of the state line – or is it simply a dividing line that we just can't move across? Yeah. Valerie, why don't you start with that, and then we'll go to Elizabeth and see what she's seeing.
Well, I don't think it's something we can't do. I think that the Mid-America Regional Council has worked on many issues that have cut across county and state lines. But there is no question, especially with federal funding and county-level funding, that those lines sometimes are a significant barrier.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing you say no.
You're hearing me say that we are still thinking about how best to do that.
How tough is it to broach and bridge the state line, I guess, Elizabeth?
You know, I think there is a real challenge as we're talking about fragmented regions, being able to bridge those sorts of divides at times. But because of the shared challenges we're seeing, we are seeing a lot more communities move in that direction. And even yesterday, from the conversations we were having, you know, as part of a conversation in the morning in Johnson County, in the afternoon, I was over in Independence, and there's similar sorts of conversations kind of bubbling up from the local level as communities share similar challenges. And now these groups are starting to talk to each other. So I think there's an opportunity to start small and grow that kind of partnership so communities are learning from each other and also trying to aggregate, you know, best practices as a region to deal with what is really a regional challenge.
Yeah. Do you see other regions being able to bridge county lines, state lines? I mean again, it's the same problem. So what do you see?
You know, in some of the regions that we've looked at who are really making strides towards collaboration, we've seen a progression sort of like what I just described, that you have, like in Cook County outside of Chicago, for instance, we saw a number of suburban municipalities starting to work together after the housing crisis. They formed these municipal collaboratives on the west and south side to sort of address shared challenges together. They've since been able to get the support of the county in that, and now the county is also working with its neighboring counties about how, as a region, they tackle these challenges. And in that situation, they're getting support from federal administrators in that region who are also trying to work together across the Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin tri-state area. So it's sort of aggregating up from the small local-level collaboration and up through the federal level, which it's very early stages yet, but I think it could be a very promising example to look at moving forward.
What's the biggest barrier to bi-state cooperation or bridging county lines? Is it the federal government? Is it local government? Where's the rub there?
The thing is, I think it's going to be different depending on what region you look at, but I would imagine there are barriers that you can encounter at each level. Just as you're trying to, you have sort of different local cultures, different modes of operating, or even regulations and how people move forward and from a legal perspective. So being able to overcome that fragmentation by finding shared processes, shared metrics, shared strategies for moving forward. It takes a lot of time. It takes bringing a lot of partners together to the same table to set a shared vision.
Yeah.
But again, I think we're seeing more and more regions across the country grapple with exactly those types of strategies because they realize, you know, the challenge is just that big.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. We're talking about the suburbanization of poverty and what that means. Let's go to Bill from Stillwell. Bill, welcome to Up to Date.
Good morning. Very good subject. I have a comment, and I need a clarification here. My comment is that it seems to me that high school graduation rates are directly linked to poverty rates. I may be wrong. I'd like to get clarification on my comment, because when you look at states of like Texas, Mississippi, others that have graduation rates in the upper 70s, low 80s, the poverty level seems to be higher in those states than states like Connecticut and, let's say, New Hampshire, and where the poverty rates seem to be lower. You know, we're looking at 90 percentile plus graduation rates versus in the 80 to 79 percentile. That's my comment. My question then becomes, if that's true, and only 20% of Americans actually finish college,
yeah,
what about the 80%? Is there anything that can be done, in your opinion, at the federal, state, and government level, now that with Brownback's cutbacks and everything, what can be done at the high school level and post-high school level, not college, not junior college, but let's say technical level, for whether it's mechanics,
right,
whether it's people
yeah
working in what can be done about that to reduce the poverty? Is my conclusion incorrect?
That's no,
my
Bill, Bill, hang on.
Thank
let's
you
get Elizabeth Niebuhr to comment.
Agencies.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah.
They had to serve.
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
So, I mean, that's an excellent question. And we do see a strong correlation between education and the likelihood of living in poverty. Some colleagues of mine at Brookings, Ron Haskins and Bell Sawhill, have talked about the three things that you need to do that significantly reduce your chances of living in poverty, one being finishing high school, one being delaying childbirth until marriage,
mm-hmm,
and another being working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're doing those three things, your chances of being in poverty exponentially drop.
Yeah.
So education is definitely a key component to this. And I think that there are things that can be done. It doesn't mean a four-year degree is what you need to be able to get a job that pays good wages, that has benefits, particularly as we think about growing productive sectors. You know, I think there's an opportunity through certificates, through community college education, to create the kinds of education pipelines that connect up to the jobs that are growing in the region that offer good pathways out of
mm-hmm
poverty. But again, it takes that sort of collaboration and alignment across sectors. You need the K-12 system. And
yeah,
honestly, this starts with early education,
mm-hmm,
through to the community college system, through to the employers, to be able to build that pipeline that give people, you know, more options to educate themselves and get the kinds of jobs that can get them out of poverty.
Valerie?
I think one thing, though, that there's no question that education is extremely important and is a huge factor in whether or not you're likely to experience poverty in your life. But the fact is that in Johnson County, among working age adults who are 25 or older who are in poverty, almost one third have bachelor's degrees or greater.
No kidding.
So they're college graduates.
A third.
And so we have to say, okay, so if these people are well educated and yet are still experiencing poverty, what in the broader system is contributing to that?
What is? That's a great point.
Well, and I always use the example of Mark Rank. It's like the game of musical chairs. You know, you have nine chairs, you have 10 people. You know, the music stops, nine people get a chair, one person doesn't. And we focus all of our effort on that one person and say, what could you have done differently?
Mm-hmm.
How could you have moved faster? How could you have anticipated? How could you? And no one says, why aren't there enough chairs?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so while it's important to try to do what we can to build community residents who are at some point inoculated from being likely to experience poverty, the fact is the broader system makes a huge impact on whether or not people experience poverty. When you have huge amounts of job loss of mid-level management types of jobs and people are ending up having to take jobs for $10 to $12 an hour, they haven't fundamentally changed.
Mm-hmm.
The job community has fundamentally changed. So we have to have a broad approach in addressing this.
But what do we know about those one-third of folks who have college degrees who still find themselves in poverty? What do we know about those people? I mean, is it a failure of the higher education system? Is it a personal failing of some kind? What do we know about them?
What we know is that as our, if we look at our jobs in our community, that increasingly a greater and greater proportion of them are low-paying jobs. Mm-hmm. It is not necessarily about the people who are experiencing poverty. It is about the jobs that are available to them in the community that they live, and this is their community.
So you're putting the blame on job shortages, the lack of availability of jobs.
I'm saying we cannot put the blame on only the person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I hope that helps answer some questions there. Let's go to Gene from Kansas City, Missouri. Gene, we're talking about the poverty out in the suburbs. Gene, good morning.
Good morning. I heard some conversation about our beginning to make these kinds of inroads. And, you know, about 20 years ago, the United Ways forced those major agencies they were funding who dealt with poverty and worked in Kansas and Missouri to share their offices, actually to close one office and become a joint office. So there is a resource already in place that has worked for a long time on this bigger picture. And I'm sure they know that. United Community Services is great at that. So, mm-hmm. But I did want to mention it.
I'm glad you did, Gene. Thanks very much.
You bet.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Dave from Overland Park. Dave, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I want to ask your guests a quick question about who are the local actors? Who are the organizations that are doing a good job? And who are those that need to come to the table and pick up their share?
Who's collaborating on this issue, Valerie? Who would you point to?
We have many organizations that are nonprofits, such as a Catholic Charities, a Salvation Army, El Centro, mm-hmm. a lot of very small organizations. The county government in Johnson County is also a very big player in the safety net, mm-hmm. in the sense of your the health and environment department, the Johnson County Mental Health, the multi-service centers. Together, they are working to making sure that very thinly spread safety net, it doesn't have too many gaps in it. The fact is, though, is that we need to step beyond that to other sectors that have not necessarily been active in this conversation, such as private business, et cetera, in order to make sure that we do have those good educational opportunities.
Yeah.
We do have those training jobs. We do have those household sustaining jobs that people can maintain their stability in housing and their security.
You know, I wanted to get to something we talked about a little earlier, Valerie, which is the psychology behind this issue in Johnson County. The Star wrote about this issue a while back and said this: as the numbers climb, Johnson County social service programs are struggling to meet the need, but they're fighting more than just a lack of resources. The story said they're fighting the assumption, and this was so interesting to me, from residents, lawmakers, and government funding agencies that everything is fine in Johnson County, where the median household income is more than $25,000 higher than the rest of the state. So how is that assumption that everything is fine in Johnson County proving to be a challenge, at least a psychological barrier to making more progress here?
It is we need to shift the perception.
Mm-hmm.
The perception needs to be not that there isn't a problem, but that an increasing number of people are experiencing this, and an increasing number of those people are us. Mm-hmm. They are our neighbors. They are our family members. Often when people talk about the experience of poverty, if they do know someone who has experienced it, they make the assumption that they are somehow different mm-hmm. than everyone else who has experienced it.
Yeah.
And if we can shift people to understand that people who experience poverty have the same values as you do, that they have the same kind of goals, they are here for a good education, they are here because they want good jobs, then maybe if we can see them as us, that we'll be more willing to do something about it.
Janet from Leawood. Janet, you're on Up to Date.
Well, I had a comment. So
yeah.
Within the last few years, my husband, we live here in Leawood, was doing door-to-door sales. And what he realized as he knocked on people's doors and offered his product, that many of the interiors of people's homes, and they shared, they were either retired on a fixed income, unable to maintain their homes.
Right.
They'd lost their job and were no longer able to maintain their homes. The interior, I mean, it was very obvious that these people were financially challenged, and they shared that. That was the reason they couldn't purchase. And it really belies, as you drive through the neighborhoods, especially here in Leawood, that many of these people are poor, But you wouldn't realize that as you drive through the town.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Janet. Great point. Thanks so much for calling.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe just a final point, Valerie. I mean, is there a reverse problem here, too, in a sense that poverty-level residents of wealthy Johnson County don't want to be seen as needing assistance, so maybe they don't reach out for it?
Well, for many of them, they've never needed assistance before.
Yeah.
And they have prided themselves on, you know, they are well educated. They have been able to hold jobs. They've been able to provide for their families. It's very difficult when you've lost that higher paying job.
Yeah.
You are working very hard, maybe more than one job, in order to make it, and you can't. And
yeah.
And that in itself, they don't want to necessarily be seen as different than anyone else.
And so they do hesitate to reach out.
And so they hesitate.
Well, what an interesting conversation. I want to thank Elizabeth Kneebone from the Brookings Institute and Valerie Carson with United Community Services for a very good conversation. Thank you both so much. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you very much.